And Jack, you're recording there. I see you have the speakers. Okay, today is September 17th, 2018. And I want to say Boker Tov, a sad morning, to my students in front of me and to everyone listening around the Jewish world. I want to dedicate the Shir Lo Aleinu, our latest Korban. It's just beyond words what we're up against every teenage Arab kid, 17-year-old, who's frustrated, takes a knife and kills another Jew. And it's one after another. That whole area, so many great people have lost their lives. Ari Fuld is from an American family, a family that all of us know. His father is one of three brothers. They're originally from Germany. They survived the war or came right before the war to the Upper West Side where the kids grew up. His uncle, who was the youngest of the three brothers, Michael, was my first student in Israel here in what was called BMT on Rehov HaBarbanel. He was one of the original 10 students that forged the first class of Torah being exported to the Anglo world. I remember when I tried to find out years later, when I first started teaching in BMT, he looked up his notes, and being a Yekka, he wrote a date on every lecture, and he gave me the exact date. I think it was November 4th, Mashu, because 1969, when I gave the first lecture. Ari's father was in Chinuch for many years in the United States. He was involved with Tsar Academy. A wonderful family. He has another uncle, David Fuld, who's done wonders with charity here. If you go to Shaarei Tzedek, the whole institute that deals with people getting married and checking that there are no problems in having children and their genes and chromosomes, whatever the institute is called, that's his uncle, David Fuld. So one after another, what a family and children most of the grandchildren, the overwhelming majority, live here, have served in the army. And the heart breaks, all right? But Medafkin Vaita, we have to go further. On a lighter note, I received confirmation of a story I've told. Yes, Yitzchak.
To add to that, not to diminish, this morning they had a fellow by the name of Reitman who was a Jewish he gives opinions on things. And he spoke that it was justified. He spoke that we shouldn't be there, that we brought it on ourselves. We have sick Jews in Eretz
Yisrael. But whoever put that in the air, they're the sick ones. That they're lamashinim alti tikva, we understand. But how do you put that on the air hours after such a murder? That was on what? Reshet Bet?
That was
a Galei Tzal. Galei Tzal. So Galei Tzal, there should be a tremendous outcry and protest. And you now have in the you see what's going on. They want to let the murderers out of jail. The news is beyond words. And the Likud, our tragedy is that Begin was a gentleman. You understand? He was elected and he did nothing. He let them stay in power. And until today, the government's the right wing. And the whole spirit of the country is left-wing. And they're the ones in power. God have mercy. We're elected and they remain in power. But that's terrible. That I can't believe Galei Tzahal. That shows such a lack of sensitivity. Hashem Yirachem. I want to mention on a lighter note that I've told the story many times that the Meitzet the Iloy, the story is documented. I heard it from people who were actually there. The Meitzet Tehillah was the first great Rosh Yeshiva who came to America. So when he arrived at the yeshiva one spring morning after the long winter, it's the 1920s, and it's before 9 o'clock, and 100 American kids are outside the yeshiva playing ball. And the Meitzet got off the train, East Broadway. He had come in from Brooklyn. And there are a few students who rode from him from Brooklyn to what later becomes Yeshiva University, but this is still on the east side of New York, the Lower East Side. And the Meitzet sees the kids playing, And er guckt dann die Kinder, he looks at the children and says, "Für was haben wir nicht gespielt in unserer Jugend? Why didn't we play ball in our youth? We would be the same, wenn wir sind dieselbe Tamidei Chachamim, wenn wir getrachtet haben, Jungen. We would be the same Tamidei Chachamim, and we would have had a youth." And that story, I just yesterday, Morty, your study partner, called me to tell me that he met people and they were eating together on Yom Tov, Rosh Hashanah, and the lady knew either a granddaughter or a daughter of the Meitzer Te'iloi, and she said, not only is that story true, but my grandfather always said that he was unhappy, and he said he attributed it to the fact that he never had a childhood. He said from the time he was a little youngster, all his father insisted he do was learn. Mendaf Levinim, and Tanish Spilim. It's a waste of time. And I got a confirmation many years later of the story that I've told and retold so many times. Okay, also I want to make a slight correction when talking about Reb Lazer Silva and the rabbinate, and that all that he was involved with. So I mentioned that there was a machlekes between the elder Rav and the younger Rav in Portland, Maine. It was Portland, Oregon. So, my Talmud Adam Rosenberg, who listened to the shiur and lives in Portland, Oregon today, told me that he checked out who the rabbi was in my footnote, and that rabbi was in Maine, not in Oregon. Nevertheless, there was plenty of machlokes between the old, and he sent the information in the shteller and what went on there. There was plenty of machlokes between the old generation and the new generation. But let me now go a step further. So we're talking about the golden era of the Agudas Rabbanim. Agudas Rabbanim, in simple English, is the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada. They barely exist today. They own property on the Lower East Side of New York, which has been regentrified, so property that was one time worth a few thousand dollars, today is worth a few million. But outside of that, you never hear of the Agudas HaRabbanim. At one time, the Agudas HaRabbanim was the foremost rabbinical association in the United States. Now we're talking about the 1920s and the 1930s. You're here in the middle of a 7-year ongoing class. I don't know how many more years it'll take. The history of Torah in the United States. And the key personality who achieved international recognition, the last practicing rabbi in the world to achieve international recognition, because today, in our world, the only ones that count are the Rosh Yeshiva. So you have famous names today, for the sake of Akron, Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky, Reb Heschel Shachter. These are Rosh Yeshiva, these are not practicing rabbis. But Reb Lazer Silva was a gaon and mastered America and spoke English, and he was persona number one in the rabbinate in the United States. Now, Reb Lazer Silva was called upon to educate, to be a judge, to get involved, to settle arguments. And we spoke about it in great detail, the kashrus problems, the arguments, the rabbis. And the last story I want to bring to your attention, very fascinating, and it has impact on the American scene until today. Some of you may be directly affected by it. I'm willing to bet that Charlie, where do your nephews, where did they go to school in Baltimore? Your brother's sons. Israel. Israel. So you're affected by this little story. What happened is as follows. Yeshiva Shibitz Kol Hanan begins on the Lower East Side of New York as Yeshiva Deitz Chaim, 1886. 1897, Yeshiva Shibitz Kol Hanan gets off the floor. Ultimately, the two yeshiva merge. By 1915, 1916, you have a high school Talmudical academy, and you have a presence in New York. New York already is big enough that Yeshiva Shibitz Kol Hanan is moving uptown. It goes to Washington Heights. Washington Heights is part of Manhattan. But Yeshiva Shibitz Kol Hanan, in its prime history, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, its students come from Manhattan and the Bronx. Every day the subway comes uptown. hundreds of kids come uptown on the subway from Upper East Side, Upper West Side, and hundreds of kids pour in from the buses from the Bronx. So Brooklyn begins the school, and you have Tairava Das in Brooklyn. By the 1930s, it's certainly on the map, although it hasn't achieved yet what Yeshiva, what will become Yeshiva University has achieved. In New Haven, there always was a frum community. And in New Haven, there was a number of rabbanim. Among them was Rabbi Yehuda Levenberg. Rabbi Yehuda Levenberg decided that, let me organize a yeshiva in New Haven. New Haven would have one advantage over New York, and that advantage is away from the multitude, away from the noise, away from all that goes on in a major city. In Europe, yeshiva generally were in the suburbs. When you talk about Slabodka, remember Slabodka was a suburb of Kovna. So easy to be away from the noise. You talk about Mir. Mir was a sleepy town where there was no plumbing yet until after World War II, basically, and even then it came in very slowly. In Mir you could find places without electricity, but in Mir you had a world-famous yeshiva. It thrived. And this repeated itself time and again. So Rav Levenberg came up with the idea that in New Haven there should be a yeshiva away from the crowd. Rav Levenberg was a Slabodka graduate, and let's get away from the big city. And he organized the yeshiva, and as a matter of fact, I can tell you a historical point and add a personal story. Who was one of the first rebbeim in the New Haven yeshiva, 1929, 1930, I believe through 31, Reb Shmuel Belkin. Rabbi Dr. Samuel Belkin, who later will become the second president of Yeshiva University, who came to Canada first in 28, a greenhorn, all of 17 years old, and from Canada came to New York to go to Yeshiva's Rebbe's called Hanan, and this was his, he was an orphan, he had, the father was killed before his eyes, he had no money, he came here, he had an aunt, I don't even know whether his family here did anything to support him, the aunt was in Canada, that's why he arrived in Canada, and he taught in New Haven, and this meant so much to him, that when I was working on my doctorate on his predecessor, Dr. Bernard Revel, and I interviewed Rabbi Belkin, Rabbi Belkin told me, and remember, you have to write that I was a Rosh Yeshiva in New Haven. He was very proud that that was his first position in America. As a matter of fact, I can tell you in parentheses that my own conclusion, and I think I make this clear in Washington, is that Dr. Belkin's greatest mistake was to leave the classroom. And he was a wonderful, wonderful Rebbe. But, all right, the title of being a Rebbe to being Rosh Yeshiva and president of Yeshiva University, the two don't equal each other. And it's a big, big Yetzer Tov, Yetzer Hara. Look at it, Vic, whichever way you want. I can add a postscript that what I just told you had a big impact on my own life. And over the years, I was offered many, many positions with many great titles and salaries and what went with it. And I always turned it down because I felt I couldn't leave the classroom. Okay? Yitzchak, I haven't said a word yet. Yeah.
It was a tragedy for him personally, but it was a blessing to the Jewish community in America.
Okay, so Yitzchak is going back to my lectures from Rav Shmuel Belkin. There's no question that what that man built was unbelievable, and ultimately it ruins his health, the responsibility, it's sad. And you all know I'm working very hard to see that someone writes a proper, definitive biography of Reb Shmuel Belkin. Tony, the reason I can't write it is I have a prejudice. I was very close to Reb Shmuel Belkin, so I can't do that. It's like idiots come to me, why don't you do a more definitive work on the Rav? because I'm the only one that wrote up my biography, but it's the only biography I have. Number one, it's 100 years too early to do definitive work. That's number one. Number two, there are things I know that I can tell you it's absolutely 100 years, because everything's going to change when certain things happen, which may be my greatest accomplishment in life, but it's nothing that we can deal with or talk about now. But it's there, and it's not going to run away. It's part of what I did this summer to secure it. And number three, if you know the person and you're in debt, you have a prejudice. Why was my work on Revel or my work on Silva, that it's already gone through four editions, each word? Because I didn't know these people. You follow? So I met Reb Laser twice. I met him as a kid. It's like Lahavdil. Joe DiMaggio was in center field and I'm sitting in the bleachers. There were 100 rabbis around him and I was a kid of 23. I met him twice. Rabbi Revel, there's an unbelievable story. It turns out that I did my doctorate and wrote my first work and became known through that work. I'm writing about my own cousin. But that I only found out many decades later. So you can take my doctorate away. How can you write a doctorate on your own cousin? But all right, I'll submit the silver book. That then I'm going to take a Baruch Hashem. Now, so the yeshiva is open. All right, with all due respects, to go from New York City to New Haven is no big deal. You get on the railroad. I think today it's called Amtrak. I think when I was going, what was it called, the New Haven Railroad? Am I right or wrong? I don't remember already. The New England, no, New Haven Railroad. I wish I had someone here from that area. Aaron Beck is from New Haven. His father was a big balabas there. So it wasn't far enough away to attract. And the yeshiva was struggling.
Did it have a
baseball game? No. This was just learning Kedusha B'Tara. That was the whole concept that it could have. Many of the students were college graduates already. America's America. But the idea was to learn on a very high level. Now, joining Rav Levenberg in the yeshiva comes over from Europe, Rav Sheftel Kramer. Rav Sheftel Kramer, does the name mean anything to you? Again, I go back in time. Let's go back to Kovna. What was Kovna? Kovna, that's where Slabodka Yeshiva began. Slabodka Yeshiva, when the Lushan closed, there's no question that Slabodka became the most preeminent yeshiva. After World War I, there's a Machlokes HaPoskim. Someone will say Slabodka, someone will say Mir. All right, it's a legitimate argument. But before World War I, Slabodka in the early 1900s, 1910 and 1920, Slabodka took over the vacuum that was left when Volozhin closed. Now, Slabodka was a center of Musa. Rabbi Yisrael Solanta had functioned there. His students functioned there. It was a very unique city. It was not just Slabodka, it was Slabodka and Kovna, but the yeshiva was across the bridge. There was a river, I think it's called the Neman River, and you crossed the bridge, and there was Slabodka, the suburb with the yeshiva. There was a very, very wealthy family in Kovna. I believe he had a flower plant, ground flour. Maybe I'm wrong, but the money was very, very heavy. The name of the family is a very well-known name in Torah circles, the Frank family. This, you all know the name Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank. Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank was a nephew to the Frank we're talking about. Reb Tzvi translated Chief Rabbi of Yerushalayim. Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank is from this family, but the man who made the money took ill, and on his deathbed he said to his wife, "We have four daughters, I'm leaving you with a lot of money, I want each daughter to be married off to a Talmud Chacham." So in this family, one daughter married Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein, later Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva. One daughter married Reb Isa Zalman Melissa, later the Kletzka Slutz Kletzk Rosh Yeshiva, father-in-law of Reb Aaron Cutler. One daughter married Reb Baruch Horowitz as the outsider Rav, and for a certain period in World War I, he gave shurim in Slabodka when everyone else was in exile. And a fourth daughter married Reb Sheftel Kramer. So Reb Sheftel Kramer comes to America, and he gets involved with Reb Yehuda Levenberg. And Reb Sheftel Kramer has a daughter who marries a young man by the name of Rabbi Jacob Ruderman, the great Eloi from the Dolavanov of Eloi. That's where he was born. Slabatka, Rabbi Jacob, Yaakov Ruderman, Rav Ruderman. You've all heard the name. So now, what do? You have three rabbinic figures, and they wind up in Cleveland. Cleveland already had a nice nucleus of Frum Jews. As we spoke about, they fought the bitter battle with the conservative movement there. And in Cleveland, there were Balabatim who wanted a yeshiva gavoha. So in the early 1930s, three rabbanim descend upon Cleveland, and they're going to bring the New Haven yeshiva to Cleveland. Now, three great personalities. The Lithuanian yeshivas had a tradition that they are family owned. All of you are aware of this. This is the greatness of Yeshiva University, Torah Vedas as well, I should say. They're not family owned. These are communal institutions, and anyone can teach there who has the goods to deliver. You don't have to be part of the family. And we can go on and on with examples. I always get upset when people say Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein was the Rav's son-in-law. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein was a gonadir. He happened to be the Rav's son-in-law, but that was only incidental to his becoming a Rosh Yeshiva in YU. It was on his own kochot. Today you have Rav Heschel Schechter. His father taught in the yeshiva, but they were far, far from owning the yeshiva. You have Rav Baruch Simon. He comes out of nowhere. He's a giant. All right? That's the greatness of YU. But on the yeshiva, the family control. The minute you get involved with family, you all know they can be machlaikit. Who's the head? Who's the boss? The money? Who accepts the students? Who can throw out the student? Who pays the salaries? There are 101 little questions that come up. So believe it or not, in Cleveland, machloket, and they call in Reb Lazer Silva, and they tell Reb Lazer, whatever you decide, we will follow. Reb Lazer comes to Cleveland, 1933, investigates the whole situation there, and issues the following interesting psak. Rabbi Levenberg is the president of the yeshiva. He's in charge of daily administrative functions. Reb Shechtel Kramer is the Reb Shechtel Kramer is the president of the yeshiva. He's in charge of daily administrative functions. Rabbi Yehuda Levenberg is the mashgiach. He's in charge of the spiritual atmosphere, the students, their behavior, and the young son-in-law, the Eloi, he is the Rosh Yeshiva. And Reb Lazer says, no student can be thrown out unless all three agree. Each one can accept students, but to get rid of students, there has to be acclamation. Everyone has to agree. And Reb Shechtel Kramer, each one takes command, and it's not working. Three personalities, three leaders, the greatest lamdam among them, the youngest one, two other well-known rabbanim. And Rabbi Yaakov Ruderman wasn't an Eloi in vain. He had a lot of world's common sense, as you know. It's one of the reasons that the rest of the yeshiva world had a lot of difficulty after it went right wing after World War II. There was a lot of difficulty. How do you deal with Ne Yisrael? How do you deal with Rabbi Yaakov Ruderman? How do you deal with someone who encourages the students to get a secular degree? Arrangements are made with John Hopkins. You all know that every Ne Yisrael student in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, until maybe recently, if at all, everyone ultimately goes to college, is self-supporting, it's not a charity case, all that goes with it. So Rabbi Yaakov Ruderman evidently was smelling what was going on in the United States. With all due respects to Cleveland, it's very far from New York. New York is setting the tone. But there's a community that's a lot closer. And that community at that time was second only to New York in Torah observance. It's the second community in the United States to have a day school, and that community is Baltimore. And Rabbi Yaakov Ruderman, right there in the 30s, goes out on his own, goes to Baltimore, organizes Ne'er Yisrael, and as they say, the rest is history. Baltimore, Ne'er Yisrael, Baltimore, one time, a YU community, Yeshiva College community. Baltimore, at one time, every large shul had a microphone. They were Samachan Heterim. The guy turns on the microphone. Once the microphone is on, the rabbi can speak, the chazan can perform. That was Ne'er Yisrael, that was Baltimore. That's the way it began. And I need not tell you, gradually over the decades, it became a different city, a different outlook, a different hashkafa, and Ne'er Yisrael is Ne'er Yisrael. It's not Lakewood, it's not the right wing in New York, but it's not Yeshiva University either. It's somewhere in between. And Ne'er Yisrael flourishes until today. It's a city unto itself. You know what I'm talking about. The campus, what they built. Rabbi Ruderman, his brother-in-law, Rabbi Neuberger, Herman Neuberger. One was the great Lamdan, and one was the great builder. And the story is told that they're married to sisters, if I have it right. And they were orphaned already. And when the Shidduch came up for with Rabbi Neuberger, Rabbi Ruderman was a little bit upset. He wasn't that great a Lamdan. And I believe it was Rabbi Aaron Cuttle who said to him, you have nothing to worry about. He will build you a great Torah institution. And kachave, and no one, the common sense, the seichel, the insight, the worldliness that Rabbi Neuberger had is legendary. So that's how Ne'er Yisrael comes to be. Coming back to Cleveland, the nucleus was there. The will, the love, the zest, give us a yeshiva gavoha. And a few years later, you all know, the two tells of Rosh Yeshiva who happened to be in America raising funds for tells, Rabbi Blach and Rabbi Katz, Mutl Katz, and Reb Avraham Eliyahu Blach, Rebbe Yemeyer, excuse me, I'm mixing him up with his brother, Reb Eliyemeyer Blach and Reb Mordechai Katz. The World War II breaks out, their families are left in Europe, totally decimated, killed. Rabbi Revel wants to bring them to New York to join the Yeshiva University faculty, because Rabbi Revel always had a certain love, I've told you many times over the decades. Rabbi Revel was autodidactic. The only yeshiva he ever studied in for half a year was Tells. He always loved Tells. And he wanted to bring the Tel Sharesh Yeshiva to New York, and they refused, and they organized their own yeshiva in Cleveland. And as they say, the rest is history. Tells went on to become, at one time, it was perhaps the second leading yeshiva in the United States. I remember the 50s, the 60s, kids ran there from high school, from all over Tells. But there, they fell into the trap of family institution. And when Rav Sarutskin died, and Rabbi Gifter was called back, and Rabbi Gifter already passed on and was not in health and then died, they had no one really to succeed. And Cleveland Tells remains on the map, but it's only a shadow of what it once was. But the branches of Tells in Chicago and Riverdale are very, very successful. Okay, Atkan. We move further. Ah, my dear students, what changed America is the story of Agudat Yisrael. It's not Agudat HaRabbanim, but it's Reb Lezer Silva. And here, let me say a few words about Agudat Yisrael. I did speak about it in great depth it must be 15 years ago or more, 20 years ago. But let me just refresh your memories. We have the naive feeling when we look back in Torah history that everything was wonderful in Europe, every Jew was from, every Jew was a tzaddik, there was no Chilul Shabbos. Unfortunately, this is not so. More than 100 years ago, the Jews were caught up with every ism in the world. And the liberal concepts, when you just heard Rabbi Rubin speak about Galei Tzahal and what he heard this morning, which is beyond comprehension. I can't believe there's not going to be an outcry. Beyond comprehension. But we have self-hating Jews, lo aleinu, in modern times by the tens of millions, by the tens of millions. You take the New York Times, all Jewish brains, Jewish money, Jewish ownership, Jewish editorship, very hard to find anyone among them who's still a Jew. Lo aleinu, this is the price we've paid for leaving the ghetto. All right, you can't live in the ghetto forever. We have to go out. It's a big world. And Jews got caught up with all these idealisms, socialism. They're beautiful ideals. Well, why should Vic has in his bank account today $10. Is that fair? And Tony, you have $10,000. Is that fair? Why? Think what I'm saying. Communism, socialism. I remember I lived in communist Russia. Yitzhak, you saw what went on there. Oh, my. And in every hotel they had English pub. Remember the English newspapers with all the communist propaganda? It was beautiful. In theory, it makes sense. It's beautiful. In reality, no one works when you're not being rewarded for your work. When the street cleaner and the skilled practitioner, medical surgeon gets the same money, each according to his abilities, each according to his needs, to quote Lenin, it doesn't work. It's just that's against human nature. And it's today it's been proven communism fell miraculously without a shot being fired, basically. But the Jews loved it, and the Bolsheviks and the Bundists, that was the Jewish group, the Bundists, you have no idea how they loved it. And just now, a communist socialist Bundist product walked into the classroom, just as I mentioned it. Unbelievable. So Yomo, once you start leaving religion, there's no end to it. The Rav raised the issue. Mori Rebbe said communism could have been wonderful without its hatred of religion. There's no need to hate religion to be a communist. You can be a communist, each according to his means, each according to his needs, each according to his abilities, etc., etc. But Marx introduced that concept, religion is the opium of the masses. That's how the Tsar keeps the people down. That's how half the population are slaves. Opium of the masses. And there was hatred and enmity. And as the Rav said 100 years ago, exactly when the communists took over White Russia, and the city where the Rav spent his formative years, Chashlovitsi, Chashlovich, as it's pronounced in Yiddish, the Rav said, in 1 year, the earlier year, 99% of the people observed Yom Kippur. 1 year later, anyone going to Shul on Yom Kippur was mocked and laughed at by the youth. 90% of the city was Mechalel Yom Kippur. So these problems went on. So intelligent Jews, among the leaders of the Jewish people, started to reach a conclusion in unity, their strength. And this is very important, the State of Israel. It's in the news right now. Achuz Chasima. What is that? How do you say that in English? I don't know. Charlie, give me in English. Achuz Chasima. The threshold of votes. So why is that so important? because we Jews are so opinionated, and the Torah calls us Am Kishei Oref. If we didn't have to have a certain minimum, you would have 50 religious parties here, not three. You follow? And even with three, it's almost for the selection. We're going to see what happens with Agudat Yisrael and Degel HaTorah. And that's the way we Jews are. And yet, but if you have unity, you all understand. In unity, there is strength. The whole concept of a strike is to tell the Balabatim, we're unified. When you're unified, you can defeat the boss, you can defeat the money people. If you're not unified, you can be bought off, and that's it. So, Reb Yitzchak Isaac Halevi from Germany, may believe you heard of the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise, the author of Dorot HaRishonim, Reb Yitzchak Isaac Halevi of Germany was a very interesting individual. You should know I taught his grandchildren here in Israel, in Michala, the Israeli branch. So very fine, very fine. Oh, what do I? Today they must be grandmothers many times over already, but very fine individuals. Taught them in the 70s. And their grandfather learned in the Lashon. Now that itself was rare, that a German Jew should wind up in the Lashon. So he had within him Yetiism, Litvisha concepts, and he had a love for Hasidus as well. If you looked at his picture with a long beard, with a bekesha, you'd think, oh, it's a Hasidus shadav. And he was very well known. And he published, he was very great in traditional learning, but on top of the cake was a nice thing of scientific Jewish scholarship. That's Dorot HaRishonim. He deals with the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Baraita, how it was written. When you deal with Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sridiyesh, they just came out with a book, Perushim, I think it's called, Perushim. It's dealing with his scientific scholarship. So he quotes Dorot HaRishonim. See, they were akin in that understanding, in that knowledge. So he came up with the idea, we have to unite. If the Jews will not be united, we will be swept away by humanism, liberalism, and all that is happening in the Western world. All right, 1912, they started to talk about it, and they planned a tremendous convention. I believe it was before World War I, I believe it was 1914, but before World War I, representatives are going to come from all the countries, and let's talk about unity. Now, this was a very difficult undertaking, because already at the preliminary meeting in 1912, when only Jews came basically from part of Germany and Lithuania, White Russia, Poland, Great Rabbanim living near each other, not that far now, they're trains. So it's very hard for the people. And that's the famous story which Art Scroll would like to deny and forget, but it's the famous story which I heard from Reb Chaim Brisker's grandchildren, direct descendants. I don't think Reb Aaron Soloveitchik makes up stories. I heard it from others in the family. So Reb Chaim comes and he's listening, sitting, and he walks out. Says, this is not Yiddishkeit. It's not for me. So they ask him, Rebbe, What happened? And he says, I heard a Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva speak. I heard a Chassidus Shadav speak. I heard a German rabbi speak. He says, a German rabbi speaks for 40 minutes, and at the Muntnisht Ein Maima Chazal, and he doesn't mention one Maima from the Gemara, from Chazal, Chachameinu Zichronon Levracha. This is not Yiddishkeit. And that's the famous story Reb Chaim told. This I've heard many times over. He tells the story that there was this little grocery in this Litvish shtetl. And the Rebbetzin comes in, and she asks this young man working there, how much are the potatoes? And he says, 2 ruble. How much are the beets? 2 ruble. How much are the carrots? So she goes over to the man who owns the store and says, I don't understand. The kid working for you, all he's telling me, everything is 2 ruble. He says, Rebbetzin, don't get upset. This kid has problems. I hire him as a chesed to the family. He puts out the vegetables, he'll deliver packages. But all he can say is 2 ruble. 2 ruble. Reb Chaim said, I'm deficient. I'm challenged. All I can speak is Divrei Torah. Outside of that, there's nothing else. Yekesher Rav gets up a fetzik minut and nisht ein maimer chazal, and he walked out and he never came back and he dies afterwards. Then they try to say, if the world were one, there's so many stories about Rav Chaim. What they don't tell you is lo aleinu, the last year of his life he had Alzheimer's, what we call senility then, Alzheimer's today, and he died 1 year later, I believe 1918. He died. Check it out. It's go online and check it out right now if anyone can. I believe 1 year later he died. He was near Warsaw. He was getting treatment. He's buried in Warsaw, right next to the Nitziv. They're buried right next to each other, which is very fascinating because neither one really came from Warsaw, but that's where they were the spinal moments of their lives. The Nitziv was trying to raise funds to pay off the debts of the yeshiva, the Lashon, and go on Aliyat Teretz Yisrael, and he died in Warsaw. I think it was 1893. And Rav Chaim died in a suburb of Warsaw where he's getting medical treatment, Atveg, I think it was called. And he was buried right next to the Nitziv. And those graves survive until today. Mamish, the real graves, not reburied, not like the Gaon, not like Rav Chaim Meiser, but the real graves survive. They refurbish the monuments and people go to the graves in Warsaw. I remember David Lifshitz telling me that if he could go to Warsaw, he then was under the communists, but David said to me, I could find their graves, I know exactly where their graves are. And he was telling me with such confidence, and today anyone can go and you're directed to the graves. So this idea of unity and everyone should be a member and all Torah Jews should join. And yes, they planned this big convocation a year or two later, sent out invitations all over the world, including Rabbi Rebel, including Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, the chief rabbi of Yafo. And everyone is invited to come and let's get this organization off the floor. Vayasu kulam aguda achat lasot ritzon cha. We have to build one organization, igud aguda, join together to do the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And this will explain something else to you, Charlie. Have you ever wondered how Rav Kook winds up in Switzerland? Tell me, are you willing to leave Israel? I don't see it. I know you go back to take care of your mother. You come right back. The great Rav Kook, you know Rakefet goes Chutz Laretz, but all right, he Avodat Hashem, Bakatev Yisrael, but he comes right back. Rav Kook was traveling to the Aguda Convention, the organizational convention in Katowice. World War I broke out. He was stranded in Europe. That's how he winds up in Switzerland. The chief rabbi, Rabbi Cohn, take Arthur Cohn, not Arthur, it's Arthur's father, but chief rabbi Cohn takes him into his house. He lives there 2 years. That's where he meets the Nazir in Switzerland. And then there's an opening in London, Machzikei Hadat. The Kehila Machzikei Hadat needs a Rav, and that's how Rav Kook goes to London. And it's after World War I, when the Rabbinate of Yafo wants him back, Yerushalayim gets involved. And he comes back to become Rabba Shel Yerushalayim. And a few years later, the British protectorate introduces the concept of a chief rabbinate. It's 21-22. And he then becomes the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of the state of Israel. All right. So Aguda Yisrael remains an idea. World War I. as a result of World War I, the pressure, the reasons, the need for Agudat Yisrael become 100 times stronger. 100 times stronger. The Chilul Shabbos is rampant. America becomes the home, the centerpiece, the heart of world Jewry. We spoke about this many times. The Zionist movement is overwhelming. Before World War I, if you said you were a Zionist, they laughed at you. After World War I, any Jew who thought as a Jew became a Zionist. But the Zionist movement, 90% irreligious. Who were the heads of the movement? Who was setting the tone? This is the time of the second Aliyah that changes the whole concept of what Israel is about, and we struggle with what they established until today, even though Israel's a democracy. And then the religious Jews and traditional Jews are the majority of the country. We still haven't changed the general tone, what you hear on the TV and on the radio and reading the papers. Okay. Come a long way, don't misunderstand me. Who would ever dream we'd have a paper like Makari Shon that can hold its own with Marav, with Yediot? Marav already is a has-been. But Yediot, Haaretz, it's beyond words. Who they are, what they think, the money they get to undermine Zionism and Torah. So after World War II, they catch their breath. And in 1919, Agudat Yisrael is officially established and launched. Here they make two decisions in Agudat Yisrael. Two decisions which color the history of Agudat Yisrael until today. Every Friday, if you want to buy newspapers in Mea Shearim, you will find out how Agudat Yisrael is maledicted and cursed, and correctly so, because they have come back on their basic understanding. 99 years ago, what are these two decisions? Decision number one, we are uniting all Torah Jews in the world. Vayasu kulam aguda achat. How do you define a Torah Jew? Any Jew who believes there can be sovereignty before the coming of Mashiach is an absolute, total, complete apikaitis. He cannot be a member of Agudat Yisrael. That's one tremendous decision. Black and white. I need not tell you, the Eid HaRedit, Al HaChoma, the newspaper, they never let Agudat Yisrael forget it. You'll see time after time, who abolished your original thinking? How dare you go against the greatest Gaonim and Rebbeim who established Agudat Yisrael? How do you sit in the Israeli government and help Jewish sovereignty? Mashiach is not here yet. That's one decision. The second decision, very fascinating. Rabbis are to make all decisions in Agudat Yisrael. There is no fence, division, partition, chasm, or cleavage between religious issues or political, monetary, mundane issues. Only the rabbis have that ability. And they introduce a concept that was never heard of before. Give it to me, two simple words. Das Torah. Da'at Torah. Das Torah in Yiddish. Unbelievable. Never heard of this before. The Gemara mentions Da'at Torah once in Masechet Chulin, I believe it's Sadi Hei, Sadi Dalet, in the Sugya on what is forbidden with the Gid HaNasher, the sinew that we don't eat. So the exact amount of the sinew that you don't eat, Das Teire, we have a tradition. That's what it means. That's the only place the Gemara mentions it. Tradition, Mesorah. It's a synonym for Mesorah. They took those words, not just figuratively, but literally. Every decision in the world. The Balabatim and Agudat Yisrael, they can decide what post office to use. They can decide what stamp to buy. They can decide what secretary to hire. They can make all these decisions. Anything of importance, not just Shas and Paiskim, but how to talk to the president, the chancellor of Germany, how to deal with the king of Spain, how to deal with the president of the United States, the rabbis will make the decision. How to deal with the Jewish agency, the rabbis will make the decision. Das Torah. And to that Das Torah, ultimately was added another layer, infallibility. That the Rabbanim, the great Tzaddikim, the Chassidic Rabbeim, the Litvische Rashi Yeshiva, they have help from the Ribbono Shel Olam, Karav Hashem LeKarav, those who call upon him, they are Hasidei Elyon, they do not make mistakes. And this was the decision. And that decision planted the seeds of the next 99 years. Mizrahi and Aguda, the endless fighting, the endless enmity. The hashkafas that our students are being taught today. There's someone that I know that was offered a shidduch with a fabulous girl, and he refused to go out with her because she was raised in Bnei Akiva. She's raised in Bnei Akiva. She wears a skirt down to her socks. She's a tzaddikit. She's shomeret mitzvah. So she was raised in Bnei Akiva, but this is the world today. It all goes back to 1919. Agudat Yisrael, what they're going through. Do you see the demonstrations against Gafni, against this leader, against Parish? Because each one has the truth. Gafni, you're becoming a Mizrahiite. You guys are no different than the Rabbi Koris Rakefet. Becoming a Mizrahiite, a Tzioni, a Zionist. Drafting yeshiva boys, they have a chance now to officially get a law passed that no yeshiva boy can be drafted against his will. It's totally undemocratic, believe me. But okay, it's a reality. Talmud is a terrible conflict here. Talmud, there are two great values that a Jew has today. One is Talmud Torah, and the other one is Tzva Haganah Yisrael. Without the army, we wouldn't be sitting here. At least on the news this morning, the army already went into the home of the terrorist of yesterday. They took measurements to blow it up. They arrested his brother. It's beyond words. Where would we be without the army? Where would we be? We have a Mossad. Where would Russian Jewry be without the work that Nativ, the branch of the Mossad that dealt with Russia, what we did in Russia? There should be movies made of it. Absolutely. I'm very proud. I'm very proud. Yitzchak, very proud. You know that Ruby Davidman said to me in his deathbed, the greatest thing I did in my life was when you sent me to Russia. Quoting Ruby Davidman. Okay? Where would we be now? These are two tremendous, tremendous responsibilities. Without Shas and Paiskim, we have no tomorrow. I'll talk about it in class. I'm going to give a special lecture from Rabbi Rachman to Rabbi Avadji Yosef. After Sukkot, I have to knock off 1 week of two special lectures that I owe Sharei Tefillin Lawrence. You know I'm nice to him, but there's a problem with his attitude that I will show you that I'm hit with in the face Monday and Thursday of every week, sometimes Tuesday too. But you see, they adopted this, that the rabbis. Infallibility. Wow. That gave birth. Poppy, remind me your first name?
Tima.
T-I-M-A?
T-E-M-A.
Tima. Tema in Yiddish. Tema. Tima. That gave birth to tremendous questions that any agudas has to face. Jack was raised in Chinuch Atzmai. He was raised in an agudas school. And he once asked the simple question, if the rabbis are never infallible, how come we have the Holocaust? How come the Belz Rebbe told 1 million Chassidim stay behind in Europe? How come Reb Aaron Cutler wrote a letter to Reb Gedalia Shoah in 1939, don't go home, I know you sold your furniture and everything, I'll buy you new furniture, nothing will happen, there will be no war. And that letter, by the way, was, I knew about it from the families. No one could say a word. It was, keep it a secret. Don't. In the Machlokes here in Israel, the Agudat Yisrael published a letter to show you Litvakim think you have great Rosh Yeshiva. Here, the letter was published about 10 years ago already, maybe more. The big Machlokes with Chabad, Ger, and Rav Shach. Ah, this is a tremendous question. I've dealt with it. But believe me, a kid will ask this question, Chinuch Atzmai and Beis Yaakov, the teacher will say, quote, when you know Kol HaTorah Kula, you'll ask questions. Until then, keep your mouth shut. And if you wish, read Washington. I give you examples when this actually happened. Quote is real. So you see, this is what happened in 1919. Now, it has to be said to the credit of Aguda, great Litvish Rosh Yeshiva and great Chassidic Rabbeim and some of the most elegant German rabbis did join together. Who stood apart and afar? They would not have anything to do with Mizrahi. This later develops in the antagonism to Rav Kook. Later to Rav Herzog, who were Gaonei Olam. And there was an element, particularly in Hungary, which refused to have anything to do with Agudat Yisrael. You take Munkacs, later Satmar, some parts of the Chatam Sofer inheritance, not all, by far, but the Chatam Sofer already coined the phrase, the battle cry, the slogan, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. It's a Mishnah in Allah. It has to deal with the prohibition of eating new grain before the Korban Ketzirat HaOmer. But they took it literally. Anything new is forbidden. The Satmar Ruv, just as he had such enmity to Mizrahi, I think he had even more enmity to Agudat Yisrael. They're innovators. They're new. God knows what it will lead to. And that's the story which I may have told you many decades ago, but I had the great honor of living in Israel. My neighbor was Rabbi Yoshua Hutner, Mamish neighbor, one floor below. We were very close, and he was married, Bezivik Sheni, he was widowed, she was widowed. She was married to Batsheva Soloveitchik, my professor of chemistry, his widow, my Rebbe's daughter, sister-in-law. And he told me the story. He grew up in a little shtetl. And his grandfather, this is the grandfather of Rabbi Yitzchak Hutner, Rabbi Yoshua Hutner, Chaim Berlin Rosh Yeshiva, and his cousin, and the grandmother, they were very frum. They were even a bit Hasidish. And they were the Rabbonim. He was the Rav, and the Rebbetzin ran the town. She was famous, an activist. And one time, Rabbi Yoshua Hutner, following World War I, got to Warsaw. First time he was in such a big city. He said he was shocked in Warsaw. They had newspaper stands where you could buy papers from all over the world, from France, from Britain, had imports, big city, intellectuals, newspapers, news. And he brought two shirts in Warsaw. And he comes back to his little shtetl, and his grandmother looks at the shirts, and they had a new style that I don't have, I couldn't stand it. Stays, they're called. You put a little stay, and his grandmother starts to cry. And he says, Baba, what's the matter? And Eti, his grandmother says to him, today it's new stays. tomorrow you're throwing away Yiddishkeit. And you see, that was the Ungarische, the Munkatsche, the Satmar, Agudat Yisrael. They'll become Mizrachiites. They'll assimilate. And this today is being thrown in the face of the Aguda leaders. You're in favor of the draft law? Oh my, a goy, an eisvaf, a krumpenik, a pushtak, a paya, whatever language you know how to maledict in. And this was a good Israel.
But you know, in Munkach,
yeah,
there was a Mizrahi eisvaf.
Of course, of course.
My father's uncle, David Rubin, was the principal of that high school.
Wow.
And he wrote a book.
A memoir.
A memoir. From Auschwitz to Munkach in Eternity.
Wow, wow.
Yeah.
In Yiddish?
He wrote in Hebrew.
In Hebrew.
And he also put out a Gemara, this time in Hebrew, before Steinsatz.
And
Yoma and Rosh Hashanah.
Wow, wow, wow. I saw that. And one second, he lived here in Israel.
He came here in Israel.
In Israel. Did you yet know him when you came?
No, I know his son.
His son. Cousin. Well, where's his son?
He lives in
Nebali. Very nice, very nice. Maybe that should be translated into English, the memoir. You should undertake that, a family project. Oh. It would have, today, memoir literature, people are interested in. You understand, of all my books, that's the one that's the most widely read. Is it important? Mm-hmm. Probably the least important. It's about Rakefet, Rabbi Suv, all the other, but the monographs, the halacha, okay.
Silver is not as widely read?
Well, silver is widely read because even in the Haredi world, it's acknowledged as the most honest work of the history of Torah in America. And the head of Agudat Yisrael in America, the Novominsk, has praised the book in public and praised the author. As someone once said a negative word about Rakefet, that he's a Mizrachiite, he opened up a mouth against them. Right? There's Baruch Hashem. There's some Mizrachiites that they admit are still from Baruch Hashem. Today, if you want to see Tzidkut, it's in Yehuda V'Shomran. You take some of those couples, some of those young people, their sacrifice, their learning, their commitment, their children, Kanayin Hara, there's nothing like it anywhere else in the world. Okay, but let's come back here. Yomo, so I'm suffering with the recording. I'm mamish suffering. I'm ready to be tied today. You see anyone here to record? That's how I see you. Mina Shemayim, my mother. Okay. Mina Kabbalah Tov. Yomo.
Someone was at
Levaya is one thing, but responsibility is also part of life. You can go to a Levaya. I know about the Levaya, believe me. You spoke about it while you were traveling here.
It ended like 3 a.m.
Yeah, it ended very late. It ended, people got home after 2 in the morning. Yeah. I can't go that. Those hours, I'd be gone. I have to live with reality of my age. And what I said yesterday, imagine, I got a pass. I don't have to fast anymore. Could you imagine Rav Asher Weiss and Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon? We spoke about it yesterday. You pick it up. It's in writing. It's all in writing. All right, but my wife said, don't you dare. I said, don't worry, I'm not there yet. I'm okay. I hope it's Rav Hashem. Should be an easy fast. Yomo, all this is happening in Europe. America's the center of the world. America's now the money center. Everything is shifted. At one time, Germany was the money center of the Torah world. Frankfurt, Berlin, all this is shifting now. United States of America, a delegation comes in 1923 from Europe to organize Agudas Yisrael. They absolutely had no success whatsoever. The only recognized Agudist in America was Rav Hirsch Grudzinski, a cousin of Rav Chaim Isaac. He was Rav in Omaha, Nebraska, a Gaon Adir. Got lost in America. He knew all of Shas and Peskin by heart. Was involved in Hechsherim cattle. You know, that's the Midwest where the cattle come from in America. The cowboys, the slaughter. He was an Agudist. Outside of that, every rabbi, every European rabbi, every name you mention, whether it was Rabbi Rosenberg, whether it was Rabbi Leventhal, whether it was even Rabbi Silva, everyone identified with the Mizrahi movement, with Zionism, with helping the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. There was no real Aguda in America. By 1937, Aguda decides it's time to once again hold the Knesiya Gedola. A Knesiya Gedola, in simple English, it's a Talmudic expression, a kinus of everybody, a convention of everybody. It's like a convention to nominate the President of the United States. You know, that's part of American folklore. Tens of thousands descend upon the city, everyone with balloons and flags. Have to have a convention. They had one in 1923, they had one in 1929, and now, both were in Vienna, now in 1937 they have one in Katowice, which borders on Poland, Germany, Lithuania. It's right centrally located. Today our children go to Katowice. It's one of the tourist attractions, and they have malls there. People go, they tell me, my daughter tells me, you go for a week, and what you buy there covers the trip. You've paid so much less than you'll pay in Israel that it pays for the car fare to Poland. And this was to be, they didn't realize it, the last Knesiya Gedola in the shadow of the Valley of Death. There would never be another Knesiya again until 1954, then 1964, and the final one you will ever see is 1980, where a guy named Rakefet attended, and if you pay him enough money and love, he'll reveal to you what he saw, what was said to him. And Rakefet walked out in 1980 saying, there'll never be a Knesiya Gedola again, and unfortunately, he was 1,000% right. Now, to this Knesiya Gedola, they invited the leaders of the Agudas HaRabbanim, and particularly Reb Lazer Silva. Reb Lazer Silva, by 1937, has achieved the premier existence of his life. He is Reb Lazer Silva. He is known all over the world. No one can raise money like Reb Lazer Silva, and no American rabbi can learn like Reb Lazer Silva. This is why the Rav loved him. And you got to remember, Reb Lazer Silva, as I told you many times, he became a gon in America. He came to America, he had the ability, but he didn't yet master all of Shas and Paiskim. And then when he had to give up being an insurance salesman and giving up these dreams of being a businessman and went into the rabbinate in Harrisburg. In Harrisburg, until 1925, 1926, he was there. It's a very small community. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there was nothing more to do in the rabbinate. He just sat in the shul and learned until midnight, until 12 midnight. And year after year, and became a gaon adir and a fabulous memory. The Rav worshipped the ground he walked on. And he was the Rav's role model in the 30s. So he's invited to Europe. And he comes to the Knesiya Gedola, and the first thing he does, he goes to visit his Rabbi, Reb Chaim Isaac Grushensky. He had studied in Reb Chaim Isaac's kibbutz in Vilna. You know what the kibbutz was? I've written about it quite extensively. Reb Chaim also was a gon sheba gonim. It's, you know, he came from a rabbinic family, and his father also, Reb Shlomo David, Ivia Rav, and what a family. Ivia was a suburb of Vilna. His father was Rav there. I still had a student, Dr. Phil Oshragai Kaslow, whose father, growing up in Ivia, remembered Rav Shlomo David Grushensky when he was Rav there. Rav Moshe Shatskis was Rav there. We'll come back to Rav Moshe Shatskis in the Sunday class. Anyway, he goes to Vilnius on the Vilna base. And if I give you all the details, we'll be here for hours. But I published. If you look into a Kafirara, I think it's Chelik Bet, there's a large Hebrew postdoctoral research on leadership in the rabbinate and what happened in Vilna. What happened in Vilna was very simple. From the time of the Gaon on, they never had a chief rabbi in Vilna. Why didn't they have a chief rabbi? Because the Gaon never took an official position, but there was a Rav Shmuel who was chief rabbi. When Rav Shmuel died, the usual Jewish story, big machloiket, who will succeed him? So the Balabatim was sick and tired of the Rabbanim fighting, so the Balabatim issued an edict, no more chief rabbi in Vilna. There are three Dayanim. The Dayanim will run the city. Let the Dayanim fight with each other. Who's who? We're out of the picture. But we're not getting involved anymore in a chief rabbi. For a nice, how many years? 120, 130 years, there was no chief rabbi. Then the Lithuanian government tried to modernize the country. And they introduced the law that every community has to have a chief rabbi in charge of marriage, divorce, so that the government will know who's who. This is part of modernity, that until the Enlightenment, no government cared. Marriage, divorce, go to your rabbi, go to your priest, don't bother us. In a modern world, the government has to know who's who. You have to pay taxes, you have to collect Social Security. They have to know who's who. So they said, in every community, we want a chief rabbi. But then they added a requirement. The chief rabbi has to know the language of the land. He has to be a gymnasium graduate. Has to know Russian. Fine. Vilna, tremendous battle right after World War I. We need a chief rabbi. And the Agudah element said, Chas v'chalila, we have Reb Chaim Moshe here, the Av Beit Din, the head of the ecclesiastical court. Don't embarrass him, he's a Gaon Adir. He didn't go to high school, he doesn't know Russian. And the secular element and the Mizrahi element elected Rabbi Yitzchak Rubinstein, chief rabbi of Vilna, of the city. Slabatka graduate, Talmud Chacham, gymnasium graduate, knew Russian, but not Rav Chaim Moshe Grishensky. He was the Gadol Hadar. And that bitter machloket lasted until Hitler. Rabbi Rubinstein was saved from Europe, got to America. Where did he teach, Charlie? Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elchanan. And if you look at the picture in 1944 of the rabbinic faculty, there is Rabbi Rubinstein in the picture. When they inaugurated Reb Shmuel Belkin, Dr. Belkin, as the second president, at that convocation, they gave Rabbi Rubinstein an honorary doctorate. He died soon afterwards. I've never come across members of a family. I don't know what was saved with them. It could be that the rest was wiped out by Hitler, but I never met or taught direct descendants from that Rubinstein family. But Reb Chaim Moshe, all right, then now he's a chief rabbi. He was not accepted by the Mizrahi, by the Agudah element, but Reb Chaim Moshe was still there, and he was Reb Chaim Moshe. And immediately, Reb Lezer Silver went to see his Rebbe. Reb Chaim Moshe, for decades, ran a postgraduate division, what's called the kibbutz. What does that mean? The most famous names in Eastern Europe did not teach formally. Reb Chaim Brisker, when he became Brisker Rav, stopped teaching. But he sat in the Beis Medrash all day, and Talmidim came in from all over the world to sit with him, and as he was learning, they learned with him, and they probed him, and asked him, and spoke with him. And this is how Reb Chaim became famous. Who paid these Talmidim? Reb Chaim was not involved in money. But I'll give you an example. Mir Yeshiva, Reb Lazy Yehuda Finkel, the Mir Rosh Yeshiva, he sent his best students to study with Reb Velvel, Reb Chaim's son, and he paid them to learn in Brisk. That Reb Velvel didn't have to be involved with money. He paid them. Reb Chaim Meiser also had a kibbutz, but his kibbutz was a little different because there was money in Vilna. People appreciated what he was doing, and they were paid, and they came, and they studied. And over the years, some of the greatest rabbinic figures studied in Reb Chaim Meiser's kibbutz. For instance, Reb Shlomo Palachek, the Meitzer Te'ili, studied there. Reb Lazer Zuva studied there. Reb Benzion Nutulovich was another great Reb who winds up in America. I think they're trying to put out his memoirs, his writings today. Grandchildren or great-grandchildren are working on it. And the top people wound up with Reb Chaim Meiser. So Reb Lazer comes to see Reb Chaim and Eiser, and this is a time, 37, imagine what's happening, Zionism, Palestine, Israel, Europe, Hitler, and he's caught up again with his Rebbe, with the Hashkafa, and Reb Chaim Meiser says to him, Mein Talmud Lazer, ich trach, as his sight as been daf grinden, and a goodish Yisrael in America. My dear student Lazer, I think it's time to organize a good Israel in America. Now, I have to say, to Reb Lazer's credit, he didn't accept it black and white. He, coming from America and being exposed to Mizrahi and Zionism and all the good that was happening in the reawakening in Jewish consciousness in America, he argued with his Rebbe in a dignified way, can't we combine the Mizrahi and Agada? See, Reb Lazer wanted to turn the clock back. He wanted to go back to 1912. In unity, there is strength. Why do we have to dismiss people who believe there can be Jewish sovereignty? And Allah had come and become it by the late 30s, when Hitler is rising and Jews are starting to run away and Eretz Yisrael has its doors partially open. Remember, the British are killing us, the white paper. But at least partially open, why can't we combine? And here I have to tell you, I reproduce some of the correspondence in the Silver Era. Reb Lazer tried very, very hard. But Reb Chaim Meiser and their letters from Reb Chaim Meiser to him afterwards, these have all been published. The gist was Reb Chaim Meiser, in theory, agreed with him. But halacha l'maisa, the lifestyles were so different that we're not going to succeed yet. The masses cannot accept it, cannot understand it. And there's a lot of truth to it. And you see, there's a miracle happening in the state of Israel which has little to do with you and me and everyone else. It has to do with the reality of life in Eretz Yisrael. And look what's happening here. On one hand, the Agudat world is opening up. They live in Israel. They love Israel. They're proud of Israel. They're proud of every soldier. They appreciate what's happening. And they want to be part of the big scene. They want to do their share. They have to do their share. Because statistics show in 20, 30 years, Haredim are going to be the majority of the people here. So look what's happening right before your eyes. And we don't have to be afraid of the big world anymore. We don't have to stay in a ghetto. There's so many good Jews out there, medical doctors, business people, high-tech innovators, SodaStream, and many wear kippah, and they're from the outside world. Ben-Gurion's not around to laugh at them, to cut their payers off. Now, look at the Mizrahi world, what's happening. So many years later, look what the Mizrahi world knew. You know what's going on? Millions of dollars are being poured in to students from Hesder Yeshivat continue learning after the army. Take another 5 years. We're giving grants. Learn, study, pass the exams, become Rabbanim, become Rosh Yeshiva, become Dayanim. Mizrahi succeeded in raising people who can build cities, who can build battle planes, that can build sophisticated guns, that can come up with Soda Stream. But the future, we need Lamdanim, we need Tzaddikim, we need Poskim. And Rav Neria knew, am I right or wrong? Do you read what's going on? They now established a whole new program in the Hesda Yeshiva. Learning should not stop when you leave the yeshiva. And if you have the ability, go further. Be a Dayan, be a Posek, be a Lamdan, be a Rosh Yeshiva, be a Mechadesh. And take a look what's happening. And you have, all right, they maintain a kippah through God. The others wear their type of hats, a black yarmulke. Others wear a shtreimel, whatever you wear. But the basic gestalt is exactly the same. Today, then this is why they're demonstrating. This is why they're yelling, they're shouting at Rabbi, at Gafni, at the associates of Gafni, at the Sephardic people. All the names that are thrown around, look at the social media. But the reality is the reality. And what Rav Silva was dreaming about back in the 1930s, by the 2030s, will be a very tangible living reality. And I have to tell you furthermore, Torim Derech Eretz, what has happened to it all over the world? Take Torim Derech Eretz. No, go to Washington Heights. Try to find Torim Derech Eretz in what became of Broyer's Gehila. No, Charlie, is it there anymore? You got to look with a microscope. Torim Derech in Israel, Torim Derech Eretz is becoming a reality. Nothing to do with Torim Derech Eretz. It has to do with the reality of the Torah Jew living in his land. In order to live in the land, you need Rabbanim, you need Gainim, you need Poskim, you need Rashi Yeshiva, you need medical doctors, you need medical research, you need inventors, you need people who come up with ideas, you need science, you need money, you need an investment system. They're talking now about cutting down the taxes on the money you make on investments because it's scaring people away, and we need that money invested. It's very important. Right after Sukkot, there's going to be an announcement. There's going to be a change. They're going to go off the 25% and go less. And all this is part of the reality of life. And take a look, wherever you turn, you see guys with kippot, with beards. One of the three candidates for the head of the police, big kippah on his head. The present head of the police, big kippah on his head. We've had heads of the Mossad, heads of the Shabbat, big kippah on their heads. We have generals where there's the hardest to break through because it was a leftist stronghold. But willy-nilly, it's inevitable. They're going to rise. I hope to meet one of the generals that I trust may one day be the chief of staff in about 2 weeks' time, Charlie. You know how? My grandson just got engaged Thursday night. So, Cholamay Sukkos, they're planning a party up in the yeshiv where the girl comes from. And their next door neighbor is a brigadier general in the IDF, well-known brigadier general. And the next door neighbor to show who she... There's some Anglos there too. I have a classmate there who was a well-known cosmetic surgeon in his time. Today, my age, they're retired. I can't retire. I got to live. But they showed Washington, got passed around, who the grandfather, Baruch Hashem, a grandson takes pride in his grandfather, Kanayin Hara. And, Tema, this is the ingathering of the exiles. It's the second Persian girl coming into my family. And let me tell you, I can tell you from the first, nothing like them. Ken Yibuv or Ken Tibena. But they don't even know they're Persian, they're Israelis. You follow? I talk about how the blood, this one, the father is American, the girl is Persian, the parents, this one, the mother is French, the girl, the father is Persian. All they know is they all went to the Technion, and my grandson met her in the Technion, and my parents went to the Technion, and I owe a great debt to the Technion, to Hebrew U, to Bar Ilan, to Tel Aviv U, to Ariel. I have grandchildren in all these institutions, Kanayim Hara. So I want to thank you, State of Israel, and I want to pray to the Rebbeinu Shelolam. We should have no matzah. Every time before he got the Tzevesh Fashtad, and we're not worthy, we're worthy of more. Have Rachem on us. That's what we daven about. Hashem, Hashem, Ke Rachem V'chanun, have Rachem. That we should be able to live and be happy. So to reiterate, what did we do today? All right. I want to thank everyone for coming. You see how many people are not here, and it's before Yom Kippur. But all right, even before Yom Kippur, we have to learn. We certainly have to learn. All right, we've set the stage. But more, the best is yet to come. What happens when Silva gets convinced and opens up a good at Israel in America, and the best is yet to come, as you will see.
Tell us about the road.
Yeah, no, we'll get there. Yes, but believe me, I wouldn't deal with this without dealing with the Rav. But we got to deal with him in context. You understand? What we dealt with 20 years ago is one thing. Now it's a new context. But it's a very fascinating. Near Israel, you see, Cleveland always wanted a yeshiva gavoha. It's very interesting. There always was that nucleus there, but near Israel, you had three. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, "Daba echad leda velo shnei dabarim leda." You can only have one leader in the generation, not two. And that's very true. That's why I could never be a dean or never be a president. All these offers I got, the Rosh Yeshiva. I can't do it because you have to be a boss. You have to make decisions. You have to fire. You have to hire. I can't do that. I can't. Before I came in Aliyah, I could do it. But as I've told you more than once, that long boat ride to Israel humbles you. I could never do it. I saw the deans. I saw Rabbi Horowitz in action. I saw Rabbi Koopman in action. Dr. Mahon Gold was a little different. Gabi was... He had inability to be tough on anyone. He was different. I read that in Washington, but I could never ever do it. But when Cleveland, so they went to Rav Ruderman Hatzeichel. He was young, had vision, had the energy. He went to Baltimore, and boy, Ne Yisrael conquered the city. But I have to be honest, it never was totally accepted by the right-wing world. And Reb Yaakov Weinberg, Rav Ruderman's son-in-law, was never a member of the Mo'etzet Gedolei HaTorah. They held it against him that he encouraged kids to go to college. Am I right or wrong? I mean, these are the facts. So it conquered Baltimore, but it also, Baltimore's a little bit different. We have to acknowledge that. Yes, Yitzchak.
Irving Yeager's the historian of Brother
right.
Jacob Agus, we were not getting to him, but he told me, because I studied with him for 3 years, he told me that he met with boys from Bnei Yisrael on a regular basis and taught them more than Ruchah.
Yeah, no, they say that that the boys from Bnei Yisrael, when they had a difficult Gemara, they used to go to Professor William Albright. And that seems to be true. I've heard it from so many people. But right today they have a problem. The Rosh Yeshiva there, who they brought in because there was no one else in the... he's not, I don't think he's family, but he's a graduate, so he's more right-wing. And there have been some bad incidents where he spoke and people were very upset with him. He's from Bnei Brak. It's Rabbaron Feldman. Rabbi Manny Feldman of Atlanta, his brother. You follow? He's not, wasn't raised on the moon. He's an American and he lived here. But all right, Bnei Brak rubs into your veins. And
you know who Albright is?
I don't know.
It's a good question. That you can ask him. All right, so we finished up Reb Lezer, then we started Agudat Yisrael, and as I said, the best is yet to come. All right, before I deal with the freebies, I want to wish everyone a Gemar Chatima Tova L'Shnat Chayim, underline the word Chayim, underline the word Osha. For Osha, that word don't underline, we're all Baruch Hashem can manage. Bayit HaGuf, underline that word, that's crucially important. We guys over 80 shouldn't have to drink Pachat Mikishia from the start of the fast. I can't get over. Wow, Rav Asha Weiss, both of them, I'm sure, Rav Asha Weiss and Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon didn't consult with each other, you understand? But it's amazing. Both are in print. Rav Rimon, you know, is the Rav of Machon Levi. He's now become a very big public figure. He's a tremendous Talmud Chacham. And he has an ability to make the halachic sources crystal clear. He has a beautiful, beautiful ability. And I taught his sister, is a precious soul, a precious soul. And his father, or it's his grandfather, I should say, was a Talmud Mufak of Rav Kook. He was a poet. The street is named after him, Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon. It's his grandfather for whom he's named there. And Rav Asher Weiss, these are unbelievable individuals. Could they grow up in Washington Heights? No, America can't turn out individuals like this. This is Totzeret Haaretz L'Tiferet. Even though Rav Weiss came here, 17, he's an American, but the gauntlet happens here. All right, so I want to wish everyone well. I want to wish an easy fast. Some freebies. Did anyone hear Rav Moshe Aaron Puleyev, Rebbe in YU for 46 years? This book was left attached to my door. I don't know who left it there on Rosh Hashanah. I found it when I came home from shul. If anyone, I have it. I have the. If anyone wants it, it's yours. We have it in the library downstairs. I'll tell you what this is about. Rav Puleyev, who I yet knew so well, Sunday through Wednesday, he gave a shiur, Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos, Rambam, Pshat. Thursday, he said a pilpul. He took one of the topics and went much deeper. This volume, which came out in 49, right before I came to the yeshiva, is on what he said on Thursday in class. And it's very beautiful, beautiful introduction. You'll meet Rav Belkin, and I learned from here about his entire family. I didn't know that. He got out, but his sisters and everyone else in his family wiped out by Hitler. You know Rav Puleyev because his grandson, Harvey Center, Rabbi Center, founded the Chavkei Kashrut. So Chavkei Kashrut goes back to Rabbi Puleyev's family. Did anyone here studied with Rabbi Leibel Dulitz? Anyone here in the room? Here's a picture of Dr. Belkin speaking. I would imagine this is Rabbi Tzolchanan's yard site. The Rav listening, and see, and Mr. Abrams is in the picture. See if you can identify Leibel Dulitz. I had a good laugh. There's Leibel. But now, these are very important. This is from the OU Center. It's their 2017 report. And I have two copies. I had such nachat reading this, you have no idea. Why? Because I'm here 50 years. I remember when the OU began here in the early 70s. It began after Yom Kippur War. By the way, it's 45 years since the Yom Kippur War, which also, my heart is broken when I think back on Bobby. And everyone laughed. What do you need an OU center in Israel? It's American. It won't succeed. Take a look at the work they're doing. And this is not make-believe. This is real. It's very, very inspiring. Rabbi Shlomo Gorman, I just want to make a comment here. The last champion of a dynamic halacha, and this is Luke Ford. You don't know who these people are from the coast. Quoting my student, Mark Shapiro, And he's quoting, Marx says, a student of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Foyer, served as the Rav of a conservative and an Orthodox shul at the same time in Holyoke, Massachusetts, about 70 years ago. Obviously, Marx is quoting me. He's not quoting me entirely correct. What I said to you was that when there was a breakaway and they organized the conservative temple, out of respect for Rav Foyer, whom they loved and revered, they wouldn't hire an official conservative rabbi. And they said, Rebbe, Vilein du Levsti Zaitun Zerab. So what they had for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they bring in a JTS student to speak, but during the year, any Shaila, they would go to Rav Foyer. And Taka on the stationery, it lists him as rabbi, but it doesn't mean he was rabbi of the shul. The Balabatim, the young Balabatim, didn't want to do anything to hurt him. That's the story. New York Times article, unbelievable. The highest percentage in America of foreign-born since 1910. And it says more and more are coming in basically from Asia, that it's changing the whole configuration of the American population. Here's a beautiful article. I saw this on TV. I saw the video. Here are their pictures. Putin meets with Chief Rabbi Lazar of the Soviet Empire, and Russian Empire, I should say, and wishes him well for the new year, and they're friendly. He's talking with Rabbi Lazar, and he says, how many children do you have? And Rabbi Lazar says, 14. And you can see Putin is about to faint. Then he recovers, and he says, all Russians should be like you. Russia has a big problem. There's not enough population. And then he blesses him and his wife and his children. This you may have heard about, the New York Times. The Education Department reopened the investigation into Rutgers, what the Obama administration shut down. Black and white evidence that they were spitting in the face of Jews in Rutgers, we're talking, in New Jersey. And now they reopened the investigation. This is our tragedy. It made me want to cry. Here's a picture of Ramaz. That's the Kilat. Ramaz Kilat Yeshurun. I know that building well. I know that building well. And that's the Upper East Side. And three teachers suspected of abuse years ago, and they're mad at Rabbi Lookstein. And again, it's the old story. No one reacted at that time by going to the police. If you know what went on in NYU, you can be mad at some of the big names there, but it's not today. I'm mad at Rakefet. I told you more than once in the early 70s, a teacher with a beard and a shtick, you know, never let anyone know he graduated NYU, made this Chaim Berlin, Tamer Vidas. He came on to a student, God have mercy, and she cried to me. So I would meet with her in the teacher's room, we sit in the corner, and I helped her. And I never once thought of going to the dean. I should, today I would go to the dean, I'd say, Gabby, either you get rid of that mamsa or I'm leaving. You didn't think that way. I dealt with the girl. She's Makira Tova until today. She's very wealthy. Married to a very wealthy family. She gives shvutami every year, something like $6,000-$7,000 in my honor. So she's makira tovar. But I'm mad at myself. But we didn't think that way. This I love. This is an article that appeared a number of years ago in Reflections on a Life by Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter. If you're familiar with Washington, that Nut Rakefet Rothkopf writes there about in his youth, he shook hands with Joe DiMaggio. This is true. In WOR radio station, he had just been interviewed. He was coming out. I was coming with my mother. We had tickets for a show to watch. Shook hands with him. I didn't want to wash my hands afterwards. Don't ask. So here, I'll never forget the first time I met the Rav. I was 6 years old and lived half a block from Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx, where my parents and I often visited patients. My wife's family, after we were married, lived right across the street from Montefiore. I envisioned this before my eyes. So he enters the hospital, where I'm summarizing, with his father and mother. And his father whispers to him with great excitement, do you see that man, that tall man? Tall. Rakefet is right, he was over 6 foot. Tall man. That's the Rav. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik. His father's telling him. After greeting the Rav, my father introduced me to him. The Rav bent over and caressed my cheek. A moment later, one of the rabbis standing near the Rav said to me, quote, "Don't wash your face for a week." And finally, the boy and girl problem. It's a great world, but you got to know how to handle it. This is from Shalavim. They now came out, they now came out, boys have to go to one grocery store, the girls to another. Me'ata, b'nei ha'yeshiva yekablu shedut b'mar kol ha'yeshiva. Ubanot ha'upana yignu b'makolet b'kibbutz levad. Zot lorech kol yom halimudim. All the boys and girls, well, they must have boys and girls meetings. Some of them get married. And I have boys and girls who met while I carried notes between. I used to have an envelope, machon gold, another envelope, BMT, another envelope, mechala. I can tell you, they are happily married with endless grandchildren until today, many of them living alat mata kodesh. So, my dear students, until we meet again in health and happiness, only besorah tova yeshuot v'nechamot, have a tzom kal, a chag sameach for Yom Kippur, which is also a chag, a Shabbat Shalom, a fabulous Sukkot, a fabulous Simchas Torah, which can drive you crazy because it's Shmini Atzeret Simchas Torah, and when it falls on Shabbos, it's all three in one day, and boy, that requires adjustment after years in East Brunswick. And until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya. Jack, any questions?
You said the masses couldn't accept the uniting of the Mizrahi and Agudah.
Do you mean that you're, what about the United States?
No,
the Rabbanim, the Mizrahistim, the Agudistim, they viewed each other as Goyim.
In the United States too?
Yeah, of course. What, you didn't grow up with Mizrahistim who said that Agudist, the Sony Israel. Right away they maledicted them. But today it's an amazing, because the mainstream, do you see,
It's changing in Israel, right here.
It's not everyone, but the mainstream. You see, the draft law, doesn't that tell you something? Who comes out against it? The Gerer Rebbe. All right, I don't want to say a word about the Gerer Rebbe, so the Zayin Gezunt, but I'm not a Gerer Chassid, particularly not of this Rebbe. Okay, that you have to understand. But look at the Litvisha Welt, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Look at the machleket going on, the peleg. Look what's going on, what went on in Panovich before. It'll be a miracle if they don't throw chairs on Yom Kippur. If I had my way, I'd shut down the yeshiva, I'd start all over. I cry for Rav Kahanim.
But what if they don't?
Rav Kahanim. It's not the Rabbanim, the Talmidim. It's either one Rab or the other Rab. If you're in this camp, you're this camp. No one else counts. It's the Talmidim. This machlekes has been going on for years. It's me Barosh. It's a family institution. In YU, they make a decision. Ari Berman is president. You follow? Here, they can't make that decision. It's a grandson versus a grandson-in-law. And it gets caught up with Rav Shmuel Orbach's, what went on here with the Peleg, with killing people. God have mercy. You know what it means to miss a wedding, to miss a brit, to miss a plane? You know what it does to your health? I go to an airport 3 hours later, earlier. People laugh at me. I say I'd rather sit in the airport and know I'm checked in than go through what I've seen happen. God have mercy, you understand? Amir Peretz, when I mention his name, I say, Shem Rishon Yerkam. You know why? He took a week away from my life. But people can do. We're on the way to the airport. We get to a call, turn back. No flights to Israel. 1 week, the airport was shut down. I had to crawl on the floor, because the way the airlines work, once your flight is canceled, you have no reservation. They have to work that way. It's not that, put me on the next flight, I'm ahead of that Chaim Yankel. Doesn't work that way. You No resume. So then the planes are mobbed. Finally, we left on a 4:30 put on flight, an extra flight. 1 week later, I slept on the floor of the airport in JFK. All because of one man, Ahmed Peretz, whose kids live in London. You follow what people are capable of doing? But all right, that's why I'm very disappointed, because my mentor, Reb Yisrael Salanter, did not win. See this one. I can drink a vodka now, make a l'chaim, I'll be the happiest guy in the world. My daughter came to me Shabbos, she brought good amount. My grandmother would go crazy over this. One malt scotch, whatever they call it, and cake left over from the kiddush in honor of my grandson's engagement. I made a l'chaim, I thought that's very nice. Just enough left for one l'chaim. Yeah, fine, I finished the bottle. I'm a happy guy. It's a zayna chassid is green. But to be a bal musa, to be an eilich yid, that's difficult. Yitzchak, you achieved it. Not everyone achieves it. All right, thank you, thank you.
Another comment?
Yeah.
You have the strength. All right. Over the years, Das taught the principles of Agudat Yisrael, and you use the word infallibility, and that's sort of a strong hint of another religion. I use that on purpose. The other principle if you don't have the right belief, if you don't have the right belief, you're out. That also sounds like Roman Catholicism.
And then
the rabbis make the decisions. In the Middle Ages, the Pope, the Church, who's going to be the emperor, who's going to be the king. The major decisions, they're so...
That's what the Mizrachim said about our goodness.
This is very Christian, very medieval Roman Catholic.
Where did you get that saying?
Okay, from what I remember.
I'm holding it for when you're going to stop playing hooky.
Thank you very much. And the guys from all that.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you've talked about this today?
No, I'm holding it to show you what I have in my library.
You know what? Who would enjoy this baby?
I had a similar
Danny Rosenthal.
I sent them to my parents. My great grandparents were from Germany, killed. They have these Stumpelsteiners, they have the stones they put in. So I did this a couple of years ago. And we were in the village.
This should be available for free somewhere on the internet.
They had a technician there, and the mayor was there. And I mentioned how my parents got out of Europe, whatever. And my mother has 117 great grandchildren. Okay. And that's her response to what Hitler did.
Yeah.
And the mayor was there and said,
"This you have to pay for to get from the internet."
117.
New York Times, you have to pay for, not for free.
How are you? How is your wife?
This is interesting.
Let's see that. What's that?
This health problem. That was some we got in.
Listen, see, the voice had respect.
What you talking about?
He didn't walk out.
Who? The wolf.
He sat.
Why would he walk out?
Because some people will do that.
May I sit down?
Yes, I have to drink.
My back is hurting me very
much. Amen. By the way, maybe Danny Rosenthal would enjoy this book.
Danny Rosenthal? Okay, that's an idea. His wife is not well.
I know.
I hope there's better news, but...
Well, Sharon is... not yet. They have to do an operation on that.
Vic, do you know how to turn this off? Stop.